This podcast may contain explicit language, which is distinct from shall and, in point of fact, as to this specific episode you're about to hear, actually does not contain explicit language. It's Friday, August 12th, 2022. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The week began in celebration, or at least contemplation, of the Inflation Reduction Act. And there was debate, robust debate, along the lines of it won't reduce inflation, or the Wharton School says it will reduce inflation only after a year or so. And then we got inflation numbers in, and they were good. That too engendered a debate. We don't have 0% inflation. We have 8.5% yearly inflation. Well, it depends on how you look at it. Well, I'm looking at it at zero. Only we didn't look at it. Because a week that started in, I'm not going to say hope, but at least in substance, has devolved into weirdness. This last week has been a Eugene Ionesco play where we are screaming about a black box, the contents of which we do not know, the import of which we cannot judge. But if you are on team must seize the box, that commits you to a belief that, I don't know, the fate of the world and nuclear weapons reside within. It's as if they don't change the nuclear codes. I thought they changed the nuclear codes. They ask me to change my Travelocity password every 6 months. Don't you think they changed the codes? But if you are on team, the black boxes whose contents we cannot know should have stayed put, then you are committed to the proposition that carting away those boxes will make us, say it with me now, a banana republic.
It feels like a third world dictatorship or a banana republic where once somebody goes out of power, the incoming regime persecutes and prosecutes the outgoing.
Most Americans now, by the way, in both parties, believe we're living in a banana republic that was just described by Scalia.
But it is now official. As of this moment in time, 21st century America, under Joe Biden, is no better than a banana republic.
That is the du jour insult. But look around the world, people. Israel, South Korea, France. Those leaders are always getting arrested. Sarkozy, Jacques Chirac, Fillon, all tried, all convicted. France continues on. Nixon would have been convicted, or at least charged, but Ford pardoned him. So much of the word unprecedented attaches itself to Donald Trump because the last worst president at least had the decency to drop the nonsense once caught. The black box test, it has been odd, it has been trying, it's not unserious, but the blather to verifiable ratio, it's like NBA offseason, but for federal prosecutors. If you want other actual developments that deserve our attention, we do have those. Unfortunately, because it looks like we have only fatwas, poxes, and polio to fall back on. On the show today, I spiel about how most of our discontent comes not from the facts of the news, but the pace of it. But first, Steak'em is a thin-sliced frozen steak brand. But man, can Steak'em tweet. The content of the Steak'em Twitter account is by turns absurd, funny, and actually quite meaningful. It's touching. It truly is at times. How? Well, the answer is the man behind the Steak'em account. He's Jason Alabach, how he turned a lunch meat Twitter account into an oracle and a touchstone. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. On The Gist, we've had on senators, congressmen, presidents, though not of America, vice presidents, though of America, Academy Award winners, Nobel Prize winners. You know what we've never had on? We've never had on a thin piece of meat. But we do today, in a form. Nathan Auerbach is the creative director of Auerbach Communications. What does that mean to you? Well, if you've ever been on Twitter, which you probably have, and navigated your way to the Steak'em account, yes, Steak'em, the thin strip of delicious but probably not great for you meat, you might find that Steak'em has a voice. And Steak'em wades into many of the important issues of the day. And Steak'em's funny. And sometimes Steak'em has some back and forth with Arby's and Denny's. And what the hell is going on here? Well, to explain all of this is Nathan Auerbach. Hi, welcome to The Gist.
Mike, thanks for having me. It's the first time I've been referred to as a piece of meat, I think. But happy
that
happy
you
for
know it. Of that the ladies haven't said behind your back.
That's right. I prefer it to my face. So it's
yes,
good.
That's right. It's not so much that I'm objectifying you as taking on the persona of Steak'em. You literally objectified or foodified yourself. Take me and the listeners through the genesis of how you got to control that Twitter account and how that Twitter account came to have the voice that it did.
Yeah, that's right. I've been calling it brand personification for a few years now. Some people call it brand humanization, but this whole kind of weird trend where brands on social media, they, in a way, they want to act human. They want to, you know, be relatable and entertaining and come across like they're not a corporate entity, that they're the person behind the account trying to, you know, speak one-to-one with people in a way. So through our agency, like I started running the Steak'em Twitter account in 2017. Within the first year, it went viral a few times for commentary on different subjects. Like in 2018, it went viral for, we did this, what's now called like the millennial thread, which is just like a thread about like the issues that young people face and why that may lead them to interacting with a brand like Steak'em on Twitter. And then it just continued to snowball from there.
So I definitely have a lot of questions about the implications of this. But first, I want to just lay some more facts. Was Steak'em a client of your company and you pitched them on this? Or did they come to you in a way seeking this kind of content out?
It was a really weird way this whole thing panned out, because by about July of 2017, we had run up our ad budget with them for the year. So we had a bunch of campaigns that were scheduled throughout the year, and we were pretty much done by like June, July. So it just so happened to coincide with a slow period at the agency. So I had a lot of free time. And in August of that year, Joe Rogan released his 1,000th, I think it was, episode of his podcast, where it had Joey Diaz and I think Tom Segura mm-hmm. on it. And they told this story on that podcast about Steak'em. Uh-huh. And people were sending it to us being like, oh, this is crazy. Like Steak'em got shouted out on this like huge podcast. So we pitched to the team there being like, hey, you know, we don't really have a ton of money right now to invest in this, but we could just jump on Twitter and see if there's conversations happening around this podcast shout out. So that was the genesis of us jumping on the account. And then I had a bunch of free time, so I ran with it.
I'm going to guess the fact that it was Joe Rogan and knowing those two comedians, they were probably, you know, they weren't too serious. They were making jokes around Steak'em. It might have been a different kind of content that you put forward as the Steak'em account if it was the Red Table Talk and the Smith family discussing Steak'em, for instance. I'm guessing.
Oh, absolutely. It was Joey Diaz talking about how Steak'em like made him fart in college, and you know, just some like absurdist stories that were hilarious. But yeah, definitely not like the, you know, the brand friendly type of stuff.
Right. So was Steak'em the brand itself? I don't know. You know, we don't want to be associated with gaseousness.
They were definitely there was more hesitation in the early stages, absolutely, for engaging with any of this type of stuff, and it took about, I would say, 6 to 8 months of us exploring on the account for them to loosen up the guardrails, I would say. But
sure,
in the beginning, they just didn't take it that seriously, because it was kind of like, well, who's on Twitter? You know, like Twitter is kind of like seen as an underdog platform versus like Facebook and Instagram and YouTube. So it was kind of under the radar for a little bit. And then as it started to go viral, they started to pay attention to it and being like, all right, let's watch what we say here. But once it started getting really successful, they caught on to it.
Well, who's on Twitter gives you an opportunity, right? They weren't taking it too seriously. They probably had, what, like 12,000 followers?
Oh, no, before? It was less than 1,000, and they were totally inactive. So there was, like, no, like, engagement on the account, which is,
So unless they did something that really redounded to the brand's embarrassment, which I'm sure they were a little worried about, there was almost nothing to lose.
Exactly.
And that gave you an opportunity.
Yep, plenty of room to play around, as I would say.
Now, in finding the voice, were you familiar with the more absurdist side of Twitter? Not just on brands, but, you know, what they call weird Twitter, guys like Drill, and I enjoy the work of Pixelated Boat.
Actually, like, I was familiar with a couple of the accounts, but I was not familiar of how broad that ecosystem really was and the history of it. And that was actually, it's funny you brought that up, because it turned out when I got on this account, that one of the first things I noticed was that they had blocked about 150 accounts in it. And I was like, this is really weird. And I was going through all these accounts, and they're all associated with weird Twitter. So I tried to figure out, like, what was, like, the history to this account. Like, something must have happened that was that went terribly wrong on the Steak'em account.
That's right. Steak'em has a past.
There's this history of drama. There was a war at some point. And I went back through and found out that whoever was previously on the account, they got in this kind of skirmish with some weird Twitter users and started blocking them. And then the one bigger account, his handle is Boner Hitler. This account had a big enough following that started to kind of like rally people to harass the Steak'em account for blocking it. That started this whole kind of like, you know, effect where they were just blocking dozens and dozens and dozens of these accounts. And it got to the point where somebody actually, his name's John Hendren, he wrote an article for the forum site Something Awful about the Steak'em Twitter account. So it kind of like iconicized it in that space. So they abandoned the account, and it was years later by the time that I kind of jumped on and started to reclaim it a bit. So when I got on, I unblocked all these accounts and started to interact with them and sort of turned the narrative around in a way that was more like playful and self-aware to all those issues and kind of won over some of those folks.
Right. So I have to say, in the history of advertising or brand management from, you know, the dawn of it, whenever Edward Bernays first decided to lend his insight into a brand up until, I don't know, 2017, the question of what should we do in terms of engagement with Boner Hitler had a very clear answer, which is do not engage with Boner Hitler. And then at some point, the answer was, well, maybe there's a way to do this right. I guess my question isn't what changed, like the whole culture changed and everything changed, but were you the first to notice that it had changed to the degree that a more or less wholesome family brand associated with lunch meats and maybe school cafeterias, that brand was right and the culture had changed enough for that brand to engage with it in this way? Were you a pioneer in that regard?
I wouldn't claim that. I mean, some people would claim that. I mean, there was definitely a few people before me prominently that
would the Arby's account on your behalf claim that?
the Arby's account. So Arby's, years before I did this in like 2015, they were doing like anime references and gamer references. So they were pretty attuned to some of like the Twitter culture stuff. And the big one that everybody points to is Denny's. They had Denny's Diner had a Tumblr account in 2013 that then translated to some stuff on Twitter. So that was very esoteric and engaged with like online gamer Tumblr culture, which is very extremely online, as I would say. Like even you referring to the weird Twitter stuff, I mean, for people who don't know, weird Twitter comes from this kind of like early internet culture of forum users on sites like Something Awful, where it was back when the internet was still the Wild West. So to give listeners context, I mean, the 4chan as a website actually came from Something Awful. The founder of 4chan used to be a forum user on Something Awful, and he was booted from the platform, and then he went on to start his own thing, which was 4chan. So if you can imagine it, like back then,
But it wasn't really as evil as 4chan has become.
Yeah, no, exactly. It was a lot more edgy and trolly, but there was less it was less integrated with mainstream culture the way it is today.
Right. And there wasn't the assumption that it could ever be. You know, these were people talking to themselves and they knew it.
Yes, these were like very tech-oriented people in a time where there weren't that many tech-oriented people. So it's like a lot of like programmers, web developers, like people that were their jobs were to be online in like the 90s and the early 2000s. So this was like before nerd culture was popular.
So was there a big hit? Was there a post that you were so deluged with reaction it couldn't be ignored anymore?
The first moment that had its kind of viral moment in the sun was the hashtag verify Steak'em campaign, which was the sort of punching up grassroots thing that we were doing through the account, where it started off just as a joke because Steak'em's account had no followers and it didn't have a blue check mark. And it was at the time in 2017 when Twitter was under some fire because they had verified Richard Spencer's Twitter account, the white nationalist. So that was our rallying cry. It was like, you know, Twitter will verify Nazis, but they won't verify this meat brand that's been around since the 70s. So we kind of ran with that as a joke, and then it started to unironically pick up steam and eventually got us like thousands of followers. And it must have been a slow news day when it went viral, but we ended up getting verified in January of 2018, and like AP News picked it up. And then the New York Times aggregated it from there. And then the USA Today did a story on it. It became this like huge story that we were kind of like totally thrown back by. We did not know it was going to take off the way it did. And that was the moment that everybody internally was like, all right, we got to start taking this account seriously.
Somewhere along the line, it stopped being ironic and started being earnest and taking some stances, and not stances in terms of this senator bad, this senator good, but trying to make, again, I'll return to the word, earnest points about thinking or earnest points about decision making. Well, a few questions about that. Tell me about, if you could, the genesis of that. And if you think that helped the brand, or was that more an expression of, because I've seen some of your writings outside the brand, just an putting more of yourself into the Steak'em Twitter account?
It was definitely both. I felt that, you know, like you said, it's, earlier on, I think a lot of the draw to the brand was the more absurdist style content. But then as we went, we started making this kind of like funny commentary about current events. And then we started to get these replies from people that were like, oh, Steak'em should run for president. You know, like, why isn't Steak'em one of our leaders in this type of thing? So we started to...
Like, you'd really want to elect a 35-year-old piece of meat, but anyway.
Exactly. Some people do, I guess. but we started to play into that then, to be like, all right, you know, people want to hear more commentary on, like, current events or whatever. So we just started to play with that a little bit, and then eventually that led to, like I mentioned earlier, the kind of big thread we did at the end of 2018, which was this kind of commentary on millennial angst and all the issues that younger people are facing and how that leads to a lot of weird outcomes, one of which being many millennials engaging with this frozen meat brand on Twitter, like sending, for example, like a lot of these kids would send these really long, sincere messages to the account asking for life advice. We got messages from like kids talking about having eating disorders, having abusive parents, like being broke and like getting kicked out of their houses, just like really just like vulnerable, random stuff that we, you know, we had no place to really comment on. And it was this situation where it's like, man, I mean, if these kids are thinking like the only place they have to turn is a frozen meat brand, that doesn't say a lot of a great stuff about where we're at societally. So we wanted just to kind of speak to that. And that really resonated.
And you would acknowledge that every, you know, 8 tweets or anything, like, don't listen to me, I'm just a frozen piece of meat.
That was a huge part of it, yeah. Like, the self-awareness of just being like, you know, I mean, just remember that this is coming from a company. The company wants to sell you something. You're never really shying away from the fact that the goal ultimately was, you know, sales and awareness. And I think people took it, it had this kind of anti-marketing effect where then it actually lowered people's guards further to be like, oh, we can trust this brand because this brand is telling us what it's doing. So that was an interesting part of it.
So you're not running the Steak'em Twitter account now, but are they still a client?
No. We stopped working with them. I think officially the contract ran out last December.
So you set it in place and wherever they want to take it now. I don't know. It's a little like when Steve Carell left The Office. Or maybe it's more like when David Lee Roth left Van Halen.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. It's to be determined, I guess. We'll see. Like, it's they've tried some different stuff while still trying to maintain some of the tone since I left. When you pass something off like that, you have to give people room to do their own thing with it. And whether that works or not, I guess we'll see.
Yeah, or maybe you'll come over the top subtweeting them as White Castle, calling them out, dunking on them. Who knows?
Yeah, right.
It's all possible.
That'd be the most meta thing ever if, like, I came through another brand and was like, this is the Steak'em guy through this other brand now. Like, come over.
I got it perfectly. You're Del Monte ketchup, and you're refusing to be put on a Steak'em. It can't be Heinz, right? It has to be Hunt's or Del Monte.
That's right. We got to punch up. That's the name of the game. So,
Nathan Alabach is the creative director of Alabach Communications. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for chatting, Mike. It was fun.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places: Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan. But nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
And now the spiel. So I was looking at Title 18 of the U.S. Criminal Code, Section 2071, or concealment, removal, or mutilation generally. I'm like, is this about the nuclear codes or is this about pimples? Do you remove, conceal, or mutilate? I like to pop. You maybe get a dermatologist to lance. No big whoop. All right. That is the comedy stylings of the FBI warrant. But of course, that section of the Criminal Code and the others, as has been reported by Breitbart, reading this correctly, Breitbart, they have been cited as an indication that maybe we needed, after all, to remove those items from a basement in West Palm Beach. If from the moment it was revealed that the FBI had served a warrant to the calls of politicization, to the counter calls of fidelity to law, to calls of overreach, to counter calls of reach, I ask, What if no one had said anything in between those developments? What if we just had a newspaper story every day? Or I'll go even better, a cable news, you know, three or four channels covering this, four or five news websites that amalgamated, conglomerated the news. What if everyone behaved in the way they should have before any information was known, or the way they would have had this news broken 20 years ago? So I'm not talking 1932. I'm not talking before the advent of telegraphs. I'm not even talking three big networks and Uncle Walter Cronkite. Just let's go to 2002. There was a Fox network. People had email. There were some message boards. Rush Limbaugh existed. But what if there wasn't a constant dopamine delivery system in all our pockets, a perpetual reaction machine that we were all hooked up to? Things would certainly be calmer. One camo-wearing wastrel may or may not have been inspired to assault Cincinnati FBI headquarters with carpentry tools. The Drudge Report, 2002, existed, but it wasn't injecting its findings into the political bloodstream. The insane overreactions of the far right would exist, but they would stay on the far right. I don't know if Representative Dan Burton was quite as bonkers as his current-day analogs, Reps Gosar, Boebert, and Taylor Greene. But if he was, he wasn't letting us in on that a dozen times in every afternoon. The online bulletin board for neo-Nazis, Stormfront, that was established in 1996. That would have existed. But again, it stayed to itself. The 2002 version of Charlie Kirk, who would have been a Rush or a Bob Grant, may well have said some of the nonsense that the real Charlie Kirk in 2022 said after Nail Gun Guy tried to bring down the FBI with a cordless Black & Decker.
We have said repeatedly to remain peaceful and stay focused on constructive things that we can do. They're now going to try to play the victim after they occupied Donald Trump's home, a military occupation. Look, let me be very clear. Violence against law enforcement is not tolerated. We shouldn't talk. We shouldn't allow it. We shouldn't even get close to encouraging it. But that cannot allow us to keep our eye off the ball.
Some numbnuts, or maybe some numbnutses, would have said something like that. But you had to be inside his audience to hear it. Would an unwell listener have taken that as a call to arms? Or would they hear those framing devices, don't hurt law enforcement, and actually take them seriously? When you heard it, did you say, he's got to say that to get his real message across, that it was a military occupation? Did you say, yeah, he's doing a paralipsis, like, I don't want to say to hurt the police, but I know the way that I encountered that clip and the way I thought about it was highly influenced by how I got to it, which is I don't subscribe to Charlie Kirk, but on my Twitter timeline, it showed up from three different sources, Media Matters for America, the white supremacist researcher Catherine Ballou. And in all those cases, they highlighted the military occupation of the quote. And they didn't tell you that around it, he said, now don't hurt anyone. I don't know how much that matters. I'm just saying in 2002, if somehow you heard the quote, you would have heard the quote without framing of this is the real way to hear the quote. There is a lot of GOP hysteria over the Mar-a-Lago search, but there's also a lot of headlines like Dana Milbanks in the Washington Post, GOP hysteria over the Mar-a-Lago search is an invitation to violence, or this one in The Atlantic by Peter Wenner. Now they're calling for violence. Trump loyalists have reacted to the search for the ex-president's Mar-a-Lago residency with unhinged fury, not saying they haven't, but who does Dana Milbank quote? He quotes Gosar, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Boebert twice. You could do that with a lot of stories. Wenner quotes a couple of those, ends with the words, "Today, it is Lincoln's party that wants America to die by suicide." If it were 2002, the speed and metastasizing of information would not be where it is now. There would be reactions and there would be counter-reactions, but there wouldn't be this accelerated cycle of hyper overreaction and overreaction to the last reaction. Nothing brought to a boil is ever allowed to cool in 2022. News cycles, when we used to have news cycles, they're like speed bumps. They're like pauses between courses. You can digest and let your never-ending hunger catch up to itself. We are not in that time. If we were, I think this entire story plays out entirely differently. There was a warrant served, Conservatives questioned the fairness. The attorney general clarified. Reporting indicates the contents may have been quite serious. Gatekeepers, remember gatekeepers? They were pretty despised. Well, in the antediluvian days they were, but they served the purpose of defining what the news was each day, or even the sections of the day, and not allowing just anyone to go nuts with the implications thereof. We had scandals back then. We had distracting scandals, and we had bona fide, soul-rending, what is America doing scandals. Abu Ghraib, that broke in 2003. But a little time, a little cooling off period, it didn't slow the momentum. What it did is it allowed us to get to equilibrium in between every development or perception thereof. The outrage over what's going on with the boxes may well turn out to be warranted. But in 2022, consideration of the question isn't permissible. Judgment off the table. We're bombarded by stimulus and response. The news isn't analyzed. We're all adrenalized. Flight, or in most cases, fight. Frenzied, unfocused fight. And that's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the assistant producer of The Gist, and Joel Patterson is the senior producer. Ian Scotto did a great job helping out the show this week. Michelle Pesca once ran the Necco Wafers Tumblr page. The Gist is produced in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oompuru-ji-puru-du-puru, and thanks for listening.